The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We're defying the studio rules by having food in the studio. So make sure no one sees.
A few days ago, we broke NHPR's no food in the studio policy for a legitimate reason. Our producer, Molly Donahue, baked a delicious homemade apple pie from a recipe that gained popularity during the American Civil War.
Okay, so we're having an apple pie. What's the Civil War part?
Well, it is a cracker and sugar pie, actually.
What?
There are no apples. It's all Ritz cracker and sugar, some cinnamon, water. And that's pretty much it.
Incredibly, the mock apple pie not only tasted like the real deal, it looked like it too.
You're kidding me. Like this stuff that, as you look at the side, that looks like apples,
yeah.
That's what...
Those are Ritz crackers that have been boiled.
So why would anybody make an apple pie without any apples?
The only real fruit in it is lemon juice.
And what's that from, like, squeeze a lemon?
Yeah.
Like many recipes, finding an original author is, you know, very rare, almost impossible. What I do know is that mock apple pie didn't start in the Civil War era. What I think happened is that the disruptions of the war made it more popular and made apples harder to come by.
That is Helen Zoe Veit, editor of a collection called Food in the Civil War Era, The South. She joined us to talk about how the Civil War shaped our notions of regional American food and what a critical role food played in the conflict. Well, those disruptions are such a big part of what your book is revealing to us. In a time of deprivation and even famine during the Civil War, what were people eating in the South during the war?
Well, one thing that happened for almost all people in all social classes, whether they were free or enslaved, is that food changed a lot. Wealthier Southerners were certainly more insulated from those privations. In many cases, especially early on, life went on more or less as normal. Imports tapered off. They weren't necessarily getting the citrus fruits they had had or the sugar. But things definitely changed by the middle of the war. And for poorer Southerners, the deprivations were sometimes very hard indeed. And sometimes, as you mentioned, even real famine, especially in the most isolated mountain areas, for example, in northern Georgia, where there really was no transportation structure to get people food in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. So what were people eating?
So, for example, if early on, one thing that surprised me about looking at food in the Civil War era South was how much food had been imported before the war, and imported from Europe, in many cases imported from the Caribbean, but also imported from other places in the United States, from especially the Midwest, where Southerners got a lot of their wheat and their pork and their beef, certainly. And so once the war started, those sorts of food imports, were cut off. And so things like meat, even pork, which I had sort of assumed was a local Southern food, you
mm-hmm.
know, Southerners were growing their own pigs.
Right.
Actually, that wasn't the case in many cases. So what had been a food economy that had really had a lot of inputs suddenly had to be local for the first time. And so Southerners were eating a lot less meat than they had been. Another thing that really changed for all Southerners was that one of their main ways of preserving foods, which had been salting them, suddenly couldn't exist anymore because Southerners had imported almost all of their salt. They'd mainly imported it from Wales, in fact. So once the northern blockade around southern shores cut off imports from Europe, Southerners had to scramble to find a way to preserve their food. And of course, in the southern climate, especially in the warmer months, preservation was absolutely crucial because if you had a side of pork, but you had no way to salt it or no way to preserve it otherwise, that food would rot. Hmm. And then you'd be wasting valuable food.
So there were a lot of improvisations we see in the book. What are some that you discovered?
Well, to get around the salt shortage, for example, some people tried to find salt in other ways. The first thing they thought of course, was that, well, there's a blockade around our southern shores, but we still have the shores themselves. We have salt water. So people tried boiling down vats of salt water, which seems smart. The problem was to do that in any sort of a scale took massive amounts of firewood to boil that water, and that just wasn't sustainable for most people. People did things like boiling old salt sacks to try to eke out a little bit of salt, or some people sifted through the floors of their sheds where they had salted to try to get up the salt crystals that had fallen for decades. Some people tried doing things like curing meats in molasses, you know, hoping that that would act as a preservative. What they mainly ended up doing was going without, ultimately.
Yeah. There are some recipes here, though. They make oysters, quote-unquote oysters, out of green corn, for example.
Yes.
So much imagination. But I'm thinking of, you know, the Southern diet as collard greens, okra, fried chicken, so many foods that we think of as Southern. Were they part of that tradition before the war?
Yes. That is one thing I talk a lot about in this book, because I think when you say Southern food, people today have instant ideas that come to mind. We think of okra or yams or cornbread or pork, and a lot of those foods are in these cookbooks, the ones from the war itself, and I also look at a few cookbooks that were published earlier. What was also there were a lot of other things. You see roast beef, you see Yorkshire pudding, you see gazpacho, you see all sorts of surprising things that we don't think of as Southern. And another thing that I discovered when doing this book was that I was also looking at Northern cookbooks. And what surprised me was how many foods that I thought of as exclusively Southern were also showing up in those Northern cookbooks, mm-hmm. whether it was, you know, cornbread or gumbo or watermelon pickles, you know, all sorts of things I was surprised to find in the North as well. And I realized a couple of things about Southern cuisine as we think about it today. One thing is that we really canonize the flavors from the Civil War era. When we think about Southern cuisine, we're really thinking about food from the 1850s and 1860s, in part because of the war. In other words, the war made Southern food special for the first time.
How do you mean?
For example, one crucial part of cooking in the mid-19th century was preservation. People had to preserve foods all the time because there wasn't mechanical refrigeration. They had to make food last. So, for example, when I think of Southern food, I actually grew up in North Carolina. You know, I think of sausages or homemade liquors or jams or fruit syrups or salting foods or smoking them. And those are all preservation techniques, techniques that people no longer needed in the 20th century. But in part because of their association with the Civil War era, people kept doing it. It became considered a part of Southern heritage in a way that we don't think of those as Northern foods, although Northerners in that same era were doing the same thing. Hmm. Another example is those collard beans or green beans. You know, people in the South still cook food to death. You know, they cook vegetables to death. They cook greens with salt pork or bacon, and they're delicious. But that was something that people were doing in the 19th century all over the country, in part because they believed you had to do that to make food, to make vegetables digestible. People in the 19th century believed that if you just ate collard greens that had been lightly boiled for 5 minutes, that it would actually literally be indigestible and would hurt you. Your body couldn't take it in. You would get sick. And so, you know, I think that this 19th century cooking technique, because it was associated with the Civil War era, became canonized, became part of people's memory of what the South was, and was one reason that people kept doing it. I think another is that it tastes good.
What were Southerners eating during the lean years of the Civil War? Well, my guest, Helen Zoe Veit, is editor of a new collection of recipes and history called Food in the Civil War Era, The South. Another big surprise for me was about how much of Southern food came from a history of conflict. And this is from the introductory essay to your collection of Southern Civil War recipes. Christopher Farish, he's describing Southern cuisine as food introduced almost in opposition to or in conflict, not just during the war, but earlier clashes with Native Americans. Mm. What are some of the foods that Southern settlers depended on then, long before the war?
Absolutely. So, I mean, when you're looking at Southern cuisine, you're really seeing a combination of European cuisines and foods and African foods and definitely Native American foods. Things like tomatoes and beans and sweet potatoes and corn, of course. You know, these are all foods that were native to the Americas before white settlers arrived. There were a lot of African foods that also became key parts of Southern food, things like black-eyed peas or okra or yams. These are all West African foods that people who had been captured to be enslaved brought with them and brought knowledge about their cultivation as well, also mm-hmm. rice.
There's a whole section of recipes in this book using squirrels, fricassees, squirrel pies. I mean, is this meant to actually be used as a cookbook or read as history?
Well, you know, I leave that to the reader. But I do think that there is, you know, growing interest even among people today who don't have to eat squirrels for any reason in sort of thinking more broadly about what kinds of foods are edible, what kinds of foods are acceptable, and also what body parts. There are also a lot of recipes in here for organs or brains or livers, you know, things that probably most people, most Americans today don't normally eat, maybe think of as disgusting. But I think there's also growing interest in broadening what we think of as acceptable.
You've now edited a collection of cookbooks about Civil War foods in the North and in the South. Did food play a role in deciding this war?
Absolutely, yes. Southerners' inability to feed themselves was absolutely crucial in deciding the war. The South's agricultural system was so productive. You know, they had a huge amount of land, they had a great climate, but it was absolutely focused on cotton. Mm-hmm. And Southerners didn't move quickly enough away from cotton once the war started, you know, mainly because they thought the war would be a short one. No one really understood the duration. They were overconfident, and they hadn't realized how, you know, how impermeable the blockade would become. You know, they wouldn't be able to import their food in the same way. And Southerners' inability to feed themselves and to, you know, to grow the food and to move the food where they needed it was absolutely crucial. And it was one reason that Southern troops, Confederate troops, deserted in droves by the end. They were hungry, and their families were hungry at home, and they were writing them and saying, come back and help me farm. We're starving.
Well, Helen, thank you so much for a fascinating book and conversation. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Helen Zoe Veit is editor of Food in the Civil War Era, the South. She's associate professor at Michigan State University and director of the upcoming What America Ate project. You'll find some Civil War recipes to try out in your own kitchen at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And a big thanks to our producer, Molly Donahue, for baking that delicious, and I do mean delicious, mock apple pie. Most Americans learned of the Pony Express as a critical part of the American movement in the Old West. Young men riding across the plains to bring all sorts of packages and parcels and mail to Western settlers. But as backstory producer Eric Mena learned, the Pony Express wasn't very successful at all, and it only existed for a year and a half. Here he is with the real story of the Pony Express.
I grew up hearing the same story you did about the Pony Express. But as it's not exactly a topic of everyday conversation, I called up my childhood expert source for a refresher.
Hello?
Hey, Mom.
Hey.
Hey. In the interest of full disclosure, my mom has no formal training in American history. Most of what she knows about the Pony Express comes from stories. Stories she heard from someone who heard them from someone who heard them from someone. I asked her what exactly she remembers.
That was the mail system in the, you know, in the Wild West. I mean, I can't give you, like, dates or anything. I'm thinking, like, early 1800s-ish. And a lot of times it was, like, they would have, like, younger men do it. Crossing the mountain ranges and riding them through the desert on a horse with no name, you know? And that's how they delivered the mail. Is that not the real Pony Express? Is there, like, more to the story than that?
Well, with no disrespect to your mother...
This is Christopher Corbett. He's a journalist and an author who's written a book on the Pony Express. I told him how my mom and I thought that the Pony Express was the main method of mail delivery for years and years.
No one ever gets that right.
Really?
People guess 10 years, 20 years, 25 years. It more or less operated for 78 weeks.
A year and a half. And Corbett says not only was the Pony Express short-lived, but the kind of mail they delivered was pretty bland, too.
They were carrying government documents. They were carrying bank transfers. They were carrying important business matters. They were not carrying love letters, Christmas cards, junk mail, and they weren't carrying packages. But other than that, Mom was right.
So other than everything, Mom was right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
The basic details of the Pony Express don't necessarily make it seem like such a bad idea. Its official name was the Central Overland California and Pikes Peak Express. Catchy, I know. It was a private venture, sort of like the FedEx of 1860, and it stretched from St. Joseph, Missouri in the east to Sacramento in the west, about 2,000 miles. Each rider, a young man, would cover 10 or so miles before switching horses. He'd switch horses maybe 8 or 9 times before a new rider would take over. The trip would take less than 10 days, a remarkable improvement on the 6 months the post office would take by steamship. Logistically, however, the business was a disaster. Each rider only carried about 20 pounds of mail at a time. That's like 2.5 gallons of milk per trip. Each piece of mail cost $5 to send across the country, a full week's pay at the time.
You could almost teach this at Wharton or Amos Tuck or Harvard as how not to run a business.
Again, Chris Corbett. He says the firm hemorrhaged money and oftentimes didn't even pay their riders.
That's one of the things I used to complain about, was not getting paid. They didn't talk about having to shoot their way through a horde of Indians, or they didn't have any of those kinds of romantic kind of Western dime novel Hollywood stories. They said they didn't get paid.
The conditions were terrible. The food was inedible. A few riders died from the weather. One guy's horse fell on him. It sounds miserable. So you've got to wonder how people came to remember the Pony Express as so great. Corbett says there are two guys to blame. The first, Mark Twain.
Mark Twain was a 26-year-old Confederate Army deserter who was going west on the top of a stagecoach in western Nebraska, and he was hoping to see the Pony Express. And the driver of the coach told him, if you sit up on the top here, you might see the rider of the Pony Express come through. And along after a while, near Mud Springs, Nebraska, Twain saw a Pony Express rider. And writing entirely from memory, 10 years later, in Hartford, Connecticut, having not taken a single note, he got a whole chapter of roughing it out of this.
No matter what time of day or night his watch came on, and no matter whether it was winter or summer, raining, snowing, hailing, or sleeting, or whether his beat was a level straight road or a crazy trail over mountain cracks and precipices, or whether it led through peaceful regions or regions that swarmed with hostile Indians, he must be always ready to leap into the saddle and be off like the wind.
And he completely enshrined the memory of the pony, and his description is not inaccurate. It's just wildly enthusiastic, and it's very romantic. I mean, okay, he's Mark Twain.
10 years later, the second guy came around, Buffalo Bill Cody. He added a reenactment of the Pony Express to his traveling show.
And from the day that show opened in Omaha, Nebraska in 1881 until the day it closed, wherever Cody took that show, in rain or in shine, drunk or broke, he took the Pony Express. It was a permanent fixture in the show. Literally hundreds of thousands of people saw the Pony Express. Queen Victoria came out of mourning to see the Pony Express. The Pope allowed the Pony Express to come into Vatican City. When Buffalo Bill got done, Eric, no one was going to forget the Pony Express, and they weren't going to let the facts get in the way.
The Pony Express shut down literally within hours of the first telegraph message reaching the West. Technology, wiping out the need for in-person delivery. Sound familiar? I asked Corbett why he thought the memory of the Pony Express is so strong even today.
I think it is a thrilling and powerful memory of the Old West. I think it's a benign memory of the West, and we don't have a lot of benign memories of the West. You know, we have memories of the West that make us understandably plainly uncomfortable. The slaughter of the buffalo, what was done to the American Indian, the exploitation of the land, you know, there's a lot of things about the 19th century West that people are uncomfortable with. But then along comes the pony. No pun intended. He carries no baggage. Americans love that memory.
It's a memory that's not going away. It's hard to imagine door-to-door mail carriers 150 years from now. We'll probably have robots or something, or automated cars that shoot your mail directly to your doorstop. I don't know. But I'm willing to bet, when it comes time to brand those robots, to stamp a logo on their sides, somebody in the room's gonna make the suggestion. What about a man on horseback? You know, the Pony Express.
And that was producer Eric Mennel with the backstory version of history of the Pony Express.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When America was young, the West was a wild frontier. People talked of its bounty and promise, but without a path to follow, making that trip was just a dream. That all changed when fur trappers and traders laid the groundwork for the Oregon Trail, a 2,200-mile route that began in Missouri and snaked its way through the prairies and mountains to the valleys of Oregon. The trail united the coasts and doubled the size of the country. In the 15 years leading up to the Civil War, nearly 500,000 people packed up their covered wagons and followed that trail in what scholars refer to as the largest land migration in history. These days, the Oregon Trail is splintered, with many parts overgrown, paved over, and all but forgotten. Our guest Rinker Buck decided to do what no one has done in more than a century: cross the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon. Rinker Buck is a journalist and writer and was longtime staff writer for the Hartford Courant and is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker, I'm so glad you came in.
Great. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm really glad you're with us. So what, by the way, prompted you to embark on such a potentially perilous journey?
Well, it's kind of a case, I think, of what makes you think I'm crazy makes me feel comfortable, you know. But what happened was I became fascinated with the Oregon Trail about 6 or 7 years ago, and I started reading up on it. And what moved me so much was how much the trail experience reminded us of the country we have today, and that the history that was important was not the history that had been taught to us in schools. So women played a very important role in the trail. Religious schisms and all kinds of America was a very, very divided and contentious religious place in the 19th century. Religion played a very big role. It wasn't one trail. It was really a collection of trails. So all of these things were fascinating to me. And then as I'm studying the trail, I come across this sentence: the last documented crossing of the Oregon Trail was in 1909. And I go, yeah, but I mean, I'm a horse guy. That's the book. That's what I'll do. And it becomes a question of whatever is eccentric or whatever is different about your childhood or your past. It empowers you. It enables you to go out and do something that other people wouldn't think to do. I had the self-confidence to know that I could get there. Now, then I got out on the trail and it was a disaster, but, you know.
But that makes a great book, and it's also a little bit memoir. You are one of 11 children. You took one of your brothers with you on the trip, your youngest brother, Nick, who couldn't seem more opposite, which made you kind of an odd couple on the road.
I understand you come from a large family, too, so you know what I'm about to talk about. You know, it's like, you know, I love my brother, but, you know, he's sort of working class and blue collar and...
And he, rather potty mouthed.
Yeah, that's the polite way to say it. Potty mouthed. I have to start using that. And I'm, you know, I'm sort of the pretentious older brother, you know, who has a college education and likes antiques and fine wine, you know. And if we had a day when we had to fix the wagon, I would offer to help him fix the wagon, you know, because we broke our wheels a lot and things fell apart. And he'd go, I don't want your college-educated butt anywhere near this wagon, you know. So it's also a story of brothers.
Well, you initially had planned on making the trip alone. Now, why didn't you?
I just thought I could do it alone. I didn't have anybody that I knew would come along. I figured I could do it myself. I had all kinds of imagination of myself riding a nice horse and leading the team of mules that pulled the wagon by a lead line and all this kind of thing. And immediately, instantly, within 2 hours of being on the trail, but especially at night when we had to make camp and take the harness off, bathe the mules, all that kind of stuff, it's... Daniel Boorstin called, the historian Daniel Boorstin called the covered wagon plainly a community vehicle. It needed groups of people in order to work, and that's why they had the wagon trains. So very quickly into the trip, I realized how lucky I was that my brother was available to come on the trip, and he's a much better team driver and mechanic than I am.
Well, why not do it in a truck or an RV with a shower? I mean, were you trying to prove something here?
I wasn't trying to, the history drove it, but I also liked the sort of narrative cocoon that I created by riding by in a covered wagon 150 years after the pioneers went. You're still seeing the same things, and you're also seeing different things, and it was fascinating. I mean, one thing I discovered that's just fascinating is, so in eastern Kansas and Nebraska, which are relatively habited, we would come to places where children would run to the end of their driveway with apples and buckets of water for the mules. And we would stop the wagon. After a while, we kind of were dodging them, but because we wanted to make progress. But we would stop the wagon and talk to the kids and everything. And I started to notice that the parents were the wrong age. The parents were all very old. And so I finally asked one of the parents, and there's a whole generation of children out in the West, Midwest, being raised by their grandparents because their biological parents, the sons and daughters of the grandparents, have spun off on, they would say to me, it was the recession and meth, you know. And, of course, methamphetamine is quite an epidemic out there.
Right, out in the West.
And then when I got back, I looked it up, and there was this huge spike in demographics. It was one of three major changes in the demography of the country that the Census Bureau pointed out between 2000 and 2010 census. And I encountered it all across the West. There's, I think it's something like 12 million children now being raised by their grandparents.
That's unbelievable.
Now, you asked me, why didn't I take a minivan? Okay.
Right.
Well, nobody's going to run out for apples for your minivan.
Right.
You know, it was so ironic. By plodding along with a team of mules and an authentic covered wagon at 4 miles an hour, I actually saw more of my country today. I was riding a sort of a social observation point than I would have if I sped along the highway in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Plus, the country's beautiful from a while.
Well, is it all still passable? I mean, must be private property in a lot of parts of the Oregon Trail. Were you able to cross it all?
Yes, we crossed it all. The only few places, there were a few places in Idaho where they put in irrigation canals that really made it. If I had to do the trip over again, I would have carried a little portable bridge. But yes, about half of the trail is now paved over mainly into small blacktops. You know, something like Route 9 in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Two-lane blacktops. And I didn't mind that at all because that's history. The road that the pioneers took turned out to be the best route somewhere. So about half of the 2,000-mile trip was on paved roads, and then another 1,000 miles was just beautiful old dirt roads right along the Platte River. And in Wyoming, there's 350 miles, and we took every inch of it, of original ruts down through beautiful places. And it's also a portrait of the generosity of the country and how it is out West now. You know, we camped in rodeo corrals. We camped on ranches. We camped a couple times on golf courses and stuff like that. So the trail's all that's still there, and the spirit is still there.
How long did it take in the end for you and Nick?
It took 4 months. You're going from Missouri to Oregon through six big Western states. And we made 79 camps. You know, we camped 79 times. So,
I'm speaking with a longtime journalist and author, Rinker Buck, about his new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It is part family memoir, and it's part travelogue, and it's part history, and part dispelling the myths of history, one being that it was dominated by men. But you, Rinker, discovered otherwise. Tell us about this woman, Narcissa Whitman.
So Narcissa Whitman was a classic product of early 19th century America, which was that she was there was a great evangelization movement early in the century called the Second Great Awakening. And so she became converted, and on her conversion moment, you know, when she was born again, she had a vision that she had been placed on earth by God to evangelize the Indians out west. To make the story short, basically, she found another missionary who was dying to go out west. He had already traveled out west, Marcus Whitman. She married him on the spot, basically. They basically had an arranged marriage and then fell in love on the trail. They got married and they left the next day to make this very perilous journey in 1836 across what is now the Oregon Trail. And it was a very significant journey because the big cultural bias against a trail crossing at that time in America was that women and children would not be able to make it. Mm-hmm. There was fur trappers out there, and those guys were kind of strange, and they'd marry into the Indians and stuff. But a white woman and kids, and you needed your wife and your children if you were going to file a claim and get free land out there. So Narcissa Whitman took the trip in a covered wagon. She was the first white woman to cross the Rockies. But what made it significant was her letters home to her family were published. And she said things like, oh, if you could see me today crossing the river in a canoe filled with all our trunks, you know. And she reassured America the rivers were safe, which was a very difficult thing in America at that time, and that the Indians were friendly. And they were initially.
So the another cowboy myth dispelled.
Oh, the cowboys
were
and
friendly.
Indians, yeah. Tragically, later on, after she settled in Oregon and everything, actually Washington State, but she was massacred by the Indians because being a missionary at that point was difficult. I'm pretty sure that's why she was forgotten to history. You know, you don't bring up someone like that and keep. But she, it was her letters home and how literate and laughing and fun they were. And the fact that she's falling in love with her arranged marriage husband as they go west, you know, mesmerized America and convinced Americans we could go on the trail. And then Marcus Whitman came back east one year and in 1843 led what was called the Great Migration. And it was the first big wagon train of about 1,000 people. Mm. And she's totally forgotten today. She had an immense impact on American history. So, yeah, I devoted a whole chapter to her in the book, and I found her quite – she was my guardian angel on the trail.
Any other revelations for you about how this trail forged not just a path west but a way of life in America?
Well, I think it there were many other things, but we probably don't have time, but like the pioneers were terrible environmentalists and that kind of thing. You could literally, by the late 1840s, early 1850s, you could navigate all the way to Oregon just by the debris pile.
Ugh.
It was America's sort of first...
first grade dumping ground.
Yeah, first grade dumping ground or a Superfund site. But all in all, it was a grand adventure. And one of the most fascinating things I read about in the book, I felt, was the cholera was very bad, of course, along the Platte River, and they didn't know how to cure cholera then. So you would sometimes pass 10, 15, 20 trail graves right beside the ruts. But what was amazing was, I quote, like Polly Coon and Amelia Jane Scott, and they would see all these graves every day, and there was so much suffering. They'd come into the camps at night, and people would be dying. But the countryside was so beautiful. Their journal would be full of the beauty of the country or Chimney Rock. And so this was a thoroughly American trait, that there was a romance, there was a beauty, there was a something larger than itself drawing us across the plains to create a single continental mass. And we did that despite the horrible tragedy that they went through.
What do you think about having crossed the Oregon Trail and seen its significance in our country's history? Mm-hmm. Do you think there is, are you ready to lead a charge or call for renewed preservation of the trail?
Yes, and there's a significant efforts that way. But I have a sort of a mini essay within the book where I rage about the Tea Partyists and the people that, you know, everyone, oh, taxes are too high and government spends too much. When you ride the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon, you camp almost every night at old campgrounds that became then called camp towns because people needed a place to stay for a few weeks until their land claim was approved by the government. Then they became resting places and big barracks and camps, the same place for soldiers in World War I and World War II. They became shanty towns during the Depression and so forth. And I explain, I just give the chain of providence what happened, but it was federal government spending that kept these places open. And then during the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's WPA and CCC workers turned these into nice places with bathrooms and showers and stuff. Well, we camped almost every night at what was originally a pioneer campground and is now a beautiful state park or something like that. So the preservation has already happened. So, I kind of make a passionate argument for preservation. And I explain a lot. There's some wonderful characters in the book who, you know, they have an old ranch and there's a Pony Express stable on the ranch. And the rancher's getting old. It's always been in his family. He's kept it up. And now he just surrounded it in an implement shed so it's permanently preserved. Things like that. It's very touching. You get a sense of the country as a generous, open place. It was a very lyrical journey.
And a very lyrical book. I want to thank you so much for telling us more about it.
It was great being here. Thank you.
Rinker Buck, he's author of the new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And you'll find a link to read more about the book, including an exuberant review from the New York Times, Dwight Garner, all at wordofmouthradio.org. Ultra running was once an anomaly in the world of competitive running, attracting just a handful of crazy people. Ultra athletes who seemed addicted to the idea of pushing their bodies to the brink. These endurance athletes who run for distances of 100 miles and more are becoming more and more mainstream, garnering sponsorships from companies like the North Face, New Balance, and Patagonia. And as more and more athletes are racing at distances that would scare off most marathoners, a rare and debilitating condition is becoming all too common among them. Megan Brown is associate editor at Outside Magazine, where she wrote about overtraining syndrome. And Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, what are the symptoms of overtraining syndrome?
Overtraining syndrome actually can mimic a host of other diseases. So it can look like leukemia. It can look like Addison's disease. A lot of what you're seeing is profound fatigue, strange muscle soreness, really strange blood counts, low testosterone, just a host of various things. Some athletes feel like they've had 6 cups of coffee and can barely sleep or have strange heart palpitations. So it really ranges.
Well, that sounds like it's something that could happen to someone who really overexerts themselves. So what's the difference between an elite runner, say, really pushing themselves in training and overtraining syndrome?
So overtraining syndrome is what happens when the body is pushed to its ultimate brink, and it really has to do with the central nervous system and how the central nervous system is able to respond. Overtraining syndrome is basically what happens when the body is in this sort of extremely stressed state for a really long time and can't pull itself back.
So there's no recovery.
Right. They're not recovering in the same way that they were previously. So the body just keeps pushing itself and pushing itself and pushing itself, and they're not getting the benefits of recovery. And so it just continues to get more and more stressed.
Is it just ultra runners who are experiencing this or other extreme sports?
There have been cases recorded in a lot of other extreme sports. It happens to mountaineers, and it happens to triathletes as well. It was called chronic fatigue syndrome in the 90s in the triathlon circuit. They weren't referring to it as overtraining syndrome, but it's essentially the same thing.
Why is it so difficult to diagnose OTS? And this is even among medical professionals who do work regularly with athletes.
So medical professionals are only starting to even know what to look for. And because it mimics so many other things, it's easier to rule out all other possibilities before you diagnose someone with overtraining syndrome. And you can't, in a controlled environment, study what's actually happening in the body, what's going on at a muscular level and a neurological level, because inducing overtraining syndrome in somebody who's healthy is unethical. Mm-hmm. And so they've really only been able to study overtraining syndrome on a case-by-case basis. And a lot of runners, they go long enough without having this diagnosed that they just, there haven't been enough cases really studied.
I imagine that to summon the kind of endurance, there has to be not just a sort of body pushing, but also a mental pushing. Is there a sort of mental strain of endurance sports or overtraining component here?
Yeah, there's a huge mental component to all of this. They say that to run 100 miles, it's 75% mental, 25% physical. So you really have to be able to draw on the mind and body in order to accomplish these feats. And there's some thinking that that sort of mental exhaustion also contributes to physical exhaustion because it's all stress on the body, whether that's mental or physical stress. So those two things are basically feeding off of each other. And if you're stressed in your mind, it's harder to make your body less stressed. And if you're stressed in your body, it's harder to make your mind less stressed.
Well, I am not one of those people who's like deeply committed to digging further, harder in exercise. But I'm wondering about whether people are kind of addicted to exercise on some level. It must make it hard for them to quit, even when their body is pleading with them to stop, because that's what training is. You just keep going.
Certainly. And I think a lot of people, even people who aren't predisposed to getting overtraining syndrome, will say it's really easy to get addicted to running. I mean, you have these endorphins running through your body. It's something that you love. And for these elite runners, a lot of them, this is how they self-identify. I mean, this is their livelihood. This is how they make money, support their family, and it's the thing that they love the most.
So what is the prognosis for athletes with OTS? Any kind of options for treatment?
The only treatment, and every sports medicine doctor will tell you this, is rest. And they don't really know, because it hasn't been studied enough, whether 2 years of rest is going to cure somebody completely. There's some thinking that overtraining syndrome never really leaves your body. I mean, some people have gone so far as to say that it changes the DNA structure of your muscles. Hmm. I did speak with a couple of athletes for this story who said even after years of rest, if they go out for a long run or have a lot of life stress going on, the symptoms come back. Rest is really the only treatment.
So people have heart palpitations, various forms of anxiety, or they have trouble sleeping. How about, you know, just in their regular daily lives, can they still function?
Yeah, in their daily life, I mean, it's definitely there. You know, that profound exhaustion is going to play into all aspects of your life. And some people do have trouble concentrating and all these other things. A lot of these people are running professionally, and so they are able to sort of step away from running and really rest. But for people who have full-time jobs, on top of training like this, it can be a really, really difficult thing to deal with.
Megan Brown, associate editor at Outside Magazine. That's where we found her article, Running on Empty. You'll find a link to read more about overtraining syndrome, or OTS, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, please write a review. Please pass it along. Please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.